Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, 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 we're back with Set the Tape Rewind, your fortnightly dose of entertainment fun time. I'm Tony Black, joined as always by Steve Norman. And we're discussing cinematic chills as Conjuring spin-off The Nun prays she'll get a good box office opening. We ponder some of the delights heading our way at the London Film Festival and contemplate just why Jack Ryan has never become a major American action hero on either the big or the small screen. Matt Latham is back again with another cassette tape before I'm joined by author Duncan Barrett to discuss his slice of World War II social history, Hitler's British Isles. So let's do this, shall we? Okay, we're kicking off this latest Set the Tape Rewind, in which I'm finally back after being away for ages for various different reasons I won't bore you with films, and we've got a couple of things to talk about this week, and the main one is that we've got another addition to the what has become known as the Conjuring franchise coming out this weekend. We've got The Nun, which is another spin-off from the original first two Conjuring films, and in fact we've just had a look back at The Conjuring, go up on setthetape.com. The Conjuring 2, I should say. I think we've had a look back at The Conjuring as well. So we've got some stuff up there about that. But it's a film I'm going to check out. Are you much of a fan of The Conjuring horror franchise, Steve?
Not overly. I've seen the first one and thought it was probably one of the better modern kind of horrors that's been probably more mainstream modern horrors. But no, I've not seen the second one. But for me, it just seems that there's a lot of horror films now that end up being franchises and end up being, diminishing returns. They always seem to get less scary as they go on. Even if the first one, not saying The Conjuring isn't scary, but in these kind of series of films, the first one always tends to be the scariest, whether it is or not that scary. And it all just seems to go downhill from there. And you kind of wonder why studios keep bothering. But maybe I'll be wrong in this case. Maybe The Nun will buck the trend.
Well, it looks quite scary. I mean, from what I've seen, it looks pretty, it's set in like a Romanian castle village. It's got a very Dracula vibe about it. It's set in like the 50s, so it's a bit period. She was really terrifying in The Conjuring 2, because that's where you first see the nun character. She pops up in The Conjuring 2, which is a take on the Enfield hauntings, which is a real life case in the 70s, or whatever.
I've heard about that. I think there might have been a documentary on Sky about that a year or so ago, but
that was a... I think there was, and there was a drama with Timothy Spall as well playing. I think it was Maurice Gross who was the actual investigator, and I think he's in The Conjuring 2 as a character. I can't remember, not played by Timothy Spall, but they did a drama, and I think a documentary. So it's been covered a fair bit. I mean, it's a fucking terrifying. Sorry, it's a terrifying like real life case. I mean, if you've ever read anything about it, like it's really scary because it sounds pretty genuine. You know, in particular, this voice captured on tape of like an old man talking through a girl, which is chilling. And the film, The Conjuring 2, is actually, there's a big debate as to which is the scarier one. The first Conjuring, which is all to do with Annabelle the doll, who then gets spun off into two films. Or the second one. I need to go back and watch them both. I was pretty terrified by the first one. I think they're both really good. But the second one was creepy as well. It left me a bit cold.
Yeah.
So they're, I'd say they're two of the better like horror films in recent times. But then, you know, you talk about diminishing returns. We've always had that, though, haven't we? I mean, if you go back to, like, Friday the 13th and Halloween, they used to do tons of sequels, didn't they?
But now you've got stuff, you know, Paranormal Activity. How many sequels that spin off? And was it four or five in the end? And the first one I thought was brilliant. It was really quite innovative and different and genuinely scary. And then everyone one after that is sort of just more of, this again.
Mm.
I'm trying to think of all the other kind of franchises off my head now, which I can't. But, it seems like quite a lot of horror films now will get a sequel or a trilogy.
But and they get prequels. And, like did you see, I haven't seen it, but did you see they did like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre one called Leatherface?
Yeah.
And you think, you just start milking it. I mean,
why do you need to know Leatherface's backstory?
That's the whole thing. I mean, they obviously do it for money reasons, don't they? I mean, a lot of these horror films, they tend to be able to make horror fairly cheaply, and they always tend to make money, you know, don't they? So that, I suppose that's one of the reasons horror quite often does well, you know, fairly mainstream horror.
I've stopped watching horrors that aren't rated an 18.
Mm.
Mm. Because I just don't find the ones that are 15 scary enough.
Mm. Yeah.
And a lot of them just seem to be 15s now to get people in the door, to get more people in, and they perhaps tone it back a bit so you don't get a full-on, you know, really horrific horror.
Yeah. Well, they're always doing that now. I mean, that's why the Luca Guadagnino, I can never say his surname, Luca Guadagnino's remake of Suspiria, the Dario Argento giallo film, might be good, because I bet that'll be an 18, and that could be pretty good in that sense. But I mean, I've always been more of a fan of, I've never been a massive fan of like blood and gore. I've always been more, I like chillers, I like things that make, I mean, that's why I like the first Paranormal Activity, like love the Blair Witch, I love that's why the first Conjuring, I like the Conjurings, because they're not blood and gore. They're all they're genuinely just chillers, you know. And
it's for me, it's not so much sort of slasher films where it's all blood and gore. It's something that's more psychological, makes you really creeped out.
Yeah,
like makes you like you've watched a horror film, you're about to go to bed, but then you end up staying up watching repeats of Family Guy on ITV2 until you can get the horror film out of your head.
Yeah. I had that kind of experience with Paranormal Activity, actually, because I remember watching it on a laptop at like 11:30 on like a November night, and I wasn't on my own in the house. I was living with my mum at the time, and she was next door asleep. But even though she was there, by like 1 o'clock when I'd finished watching that, I was just a mess. I was no way. I had to just like put on... something funny.
We watched it at the cinema when I was at university, Paranormal Activity, and then we just went home and watched ghost videos till 3 a.m. and then no one could sleep.
yeah. That's it. That's why it's a good horror film, though, because it's sort of, you know, that's the point. That's what it should be doing. It should be really sort of getting under your skin. And a lot of these, they don't. And, I'd say that about, like, the Conjuring films. They do get under your skin a bit. And I found, hopefully the Nun will do the same, you know, so... we'll see, but it's definitely continuing the Conjuring franchise, and you know quite a lot of people liked Annabelle Creation last year, which I thought wasn't bad, but certainly better than the first Annabelle spin-off. So you know, fingers crossed, it'll be good. But that's coming out. We should have a review of that up. And as I say, we've got the Conjuring lookbacks you can find on setthetape.com. But apart from all this, and I mentioned Suspiria earlier, and this is going to factor in at the London Film Festival, which is kicking off very soon. And our writer, Callum Petch, is going to be there, and he's done a preview, which is on the site right now. Have you seen much of what the lineup is, Steve, for this?
No, not yet. I've not had much of a chance to see what's happening at the London Film Festival.
I mean the big one is the big premiere of Widows, which is Steve McQueen's latest, as of the guy who did 12 Years a Slave and Shame with Fassbender. And so this guy, it's got a brilliant cast. It's based on the Linda LaPlante book. So you remember Linda LaPlante, who used to do all those like ITV dramas of her books?
Yeah.
I think they did Widows back in the day. But they've remade that with a great cast. So that's one. I think there's also the Laurel and Hardy biopic with Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly. That looks fun. That's good casting, I think, for them too.
Yeah.
So that could be quite good. And as I say, Suspiria is another one. But, you know, it's a pretty good film festival. I don't know. I mean, have you ever done any film festivals or anything like that? Have you ever been to any of them?
No, but I do live out on a limb. And, you know, it takes me half an hour to get to anywhere, let alone a film festival. the one that they have in my local area is one that's going to have sort of big premieres. They occasionally have a few semi-interesting guest speakers they do some quite nice outside screenings of films.
Yeah.
They do well for the size they are, but it's not really kind of the big deal. And then the next nearest one, I'd probably have to travel for at least an hour. So no, not really the most viable thing for me.
Yeah, we don't get a fat lot in Birmingham.
Not until you lot can start putting me up to travel to these things and pay my expenses.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the number one priority of Set the Tape, let's be honest.
Sending me off to film festivals,
yeah. And making Steve our roving reporter, yeah.
Yeah.
but yeah, we're going to have a lot more on the London Film Festival, I think, coming up from various people who are going to be there, I think. So, yeah, check out Callum's preview with some really good stuff on a real range of films. You know, I mean, Callum is a machine with these kind of things. I think he really gets to see almost all of it. So check that out, because it's a good preview. That's on setthetape.com.
Hello, everyone. It's Latham here with The Cassette Tape. Let's talk about surprise albums, or more specifically, Eminem's one that he dropped last Friday. Kamikaze is Eminem's 10th album, and seems to be setting out with the one goal of calling out everyone who's ever ticked him off and said negative things about his previous album. Eminem has always been at his best when he's been the angry young man calling out against his own issues. It's not all been plain sailing, and there are still parts of his lyrics that can be questionable, but his flow and his ability to manipulate rhyming and still paint vivid images and tell stories are still responsible for some of the best rap verses that have ever been written. But is Eminem now the old man sitting on his porch yelling at youngsters? In other genres, musicians with longer careers may tail off in their heyday, but they always seem to be held in some kind of high regard. Rap seems to be different. The older you get, the more you seem to be seen to stop rhyming and start producing and make way for the younger generation. In Eminem's case, it's a double-edged sword. His skills are no doubt improving, but his subject matter still seems to be about the same things. The Marshall Mathers LP2 is him looking back, trying to play off his magnum opus from over a decade ago. But since watching Anthony Fantano's review of Kamikaze a bit earlier, I am reminded that a lot of his best work is done when he's reactive. But he still manages to be able to try and get some proactivity in his lyrics and in his songs, which I think Kamikaze does admittedly lack. I don't think he could ever really retire. Eminem made white rap a respectable thing, and it appears that his next hurdle to jump might be trying to break off this older rapper stigma. Will he do it? I'm not sure. Finally, The only album to be aware of in the next fortnight in this edition of Fast Forward is Pale Wave's debut, My Mind Makes Some Noises, which comes out on September the 14th. I do feel as if Dirty Hit, the record label behind Pale Waves, are trying to make the next Wolf Alice. Wolf Alice are a quartet influenced by the 90s grunge movement, in the same way that Pale Waves appear to be influenced by the 1980s new wave movement, kind of from like The Cure. The only worry I have with the album, though, is that I've got a sneaky suspicion that a lot of the singles that are on the album have already been released. Whereas with Wolf Alice, we had the EP, we had the major hit, Mona Lisa Smile, but then when the album came out, a lot of the songs were new and we'd not heard them before, and they took us by surprise. Here, I'm a bit nervous, I'm not too sure. It's a shame because the singles that have been released have been so catchy and they've been brilliant and they're quite exciting. I hope I am proved wrong though, as I am really looking forward to the album. Until then, this has been The Cassette Tape.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Okay, TV now, and I'm kind of gonna cheat a bit here because I'm gonna sort of blend this with some more movie chat, but it's relevant because we've just had on Amazon Prime land the Jack Ryan TV series, which is starring John Krasinski as Tom Clancy's CIA analyst character from his books. Obviously he died a few years ago, Tom Clancy, but he wrote over years, Jack Ryan was probably his biggest character that he wrote for years in his books, and then went on to be films like Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger, The Sum of All Fears, things like this, and now it's a TV series which I admit I haven't yet watched. It's very close, it's on my my list. I'm going to do it pretty soon. It's only 8 episodes. I've been wondering about this for a while. Have you seen, are you very familiar with any of this, Steve? Any of this character or these books or the films?
Not overly, no. I think I've seen Sum of All Fears. Was that a Jack Ryan thing with Ben Affleck?
Yeah, that's it.
I've seen that. And other than that, I can't think of anything else I've really seen, to be honest.
Did you see Harrison Ford in playing the character? Because he did...
Yes, I have seen.
He did Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. He did two in like the early 90s.
Yeah.
And Patriot Games was all about the IRA, if I remember rightly. And he has to... It's one of those... I mean, Patriot Games is good, but it's got Sean Bean as the baddie, obviously. Like, standard. Yeah. And it's got a lot of dodgy Irish accents, you know, and it's at that point where, you know, the IRA are the bad guys and all this kind of thing. But it does have one of the best, like, action climaxes I think I've ever seen in a film. This amazing, like, boat chase at night with rain. When it's pouring down with rain, it's really good. Fight on a boat. And then Clear and Present Danger, which is one of my favourite films. I love that film. It's really good. It's very different. It's all about like fighting against Colombian drug lords and like secret American ops going in and things like that. But the thing is, it's one of them that like Harrison Ford only did two and he was good in them. But people don't always remember it over things like, you know, Indiana Jones, obviously, or say The Fugitive and stuff like that. And I think it's because he wasn't a traditional sort of action hero. He was like quite a bookish CIA guy. It wasn't like He wasn't like Bond, you know. He wasn't like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible. He was more of a guy behind a desk. And that's why... Do you remember Ben Affleck in that one? He's quite shabby. Like, he...
Yeah.
He doesn't do all the slick shooting.
No.
And I think... I don't know if people really knew what to do with that. But then, do you remember Chris Pine did one called Shadow Recruit? Do you even remember this film?
I don't remember it, no.
No. Exactly.
No. Saying that Chris Pine did one does ring a bell now, but I can't... think anything about it.
Exactly. It was about 4 years ago, and it was Kenneth Branagh directed it, bizarrely, and he was the bad guy in it. And it was called Shadow Recruit, and it's basically, you know, the origin story again. And he's more of an action Jack Ryan, and nobody went to see it, like, and nobody liked it. I mean, I went to see it, and I thought it was pretty crap, really. And nobody remembers it now, and they tried to make him into a sort of not an American James Bond, but they tried to make him into an action star, and it never worked. And I keep wondering why. On paper, you've got The Hunt for Red October was another one where Alec Baldwin played him. Do you remember The Hunt for Red October with Connery as a Russian submarine commander? Have you seen that?
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it, but I know of it.
Yeah, he's a Russian submarine commander who talks like Sean Connery, basically. So he's like, I'm a Russian submarine commander. All the way through, and you're like, are you really? Are you sure?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Alec Baldwin in that. And so, again, he didn't really stand out in that. I keep just wondering why it doesn't take off. Like, because on paper, a character like this should really, surely, you know.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe a lot of people have just read the books. And they know, I don't know, because you've got stuff like Jason Bourne that takes off, and it's a similar kind of thing. Mm. You know, it's not exactly the same, but it's in the same ballpark, and that takes off. And you just wonder why one works and one doesn't.
Yeah, actually, you're right, because the Bourne films, again, they came from books, and the books are... Have you ever read any of the Bourne books? They're really hard work.
No.
They're really dry.
Yeah.
They're quite dry, and, you know, they're just a bit boring, to be honest. They're just a bit boring and old-fashioned, and, like, they managed to turn that into, you know, Matt Damon kicking ass. It just seems weird, but this new one does look like they're trying to do that. You know, John Krasinski, who was... from The Office and A Quiet Place as well. He's quite good.
Yeah, I mean, I've not seen A Quiet Place, but it does look interesting. But I mean, with him, it's going to take me a while to believe him as anything else other than Jim from The Office. It actually happened with Martin Freeman, who played the equivalent role in the original Office. Like, it took me a while to see him as anything other than Tim. John Krasinski doesn't really strike me as kind of an action star or action character, although I've seen him in a few other things like that. What was the other? There's another kind of military. He was like a marine or soldier in something relatively recently.
And oh, was it that bloody awful 13 Hours thing?
It might have been. Yeah.
Oh, that was. But terrible.
It's sort of like I can't. You know how it takes a while to get your head around somebody being that kind of character. I think, what was the show on Netflix recently? Was it called Safe? It had the guy from Dexter in it. And me trying to get my head around his British accent took me about 3 episodes.
Did you stick with it?
I did.
Because I watched the first 2 or 3.
Yeah.
God, it was terrible.
I thought it was quite good. It was quite predictable in some of the way that it panned out, but it was quite good as something just to binge watch over the space of a couple of days. But it did take me about 3 episodes to get my head around his British accent, with me just thinking, I just kept thinking, why not cast a British guy or just make him an American guy living in Britain?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was, and his accent was awful.
I just thought
was really stolid. You know, he's like this old Brian. Oh yeah, you know. But I'm like,
I just thought he's not that much of a big of a pull as an actor. Surely that you can, you need to give him the British accent. It's not really weird. Like it's this huge American actor. Or just say, right, do a British accent, go in there and do that. It's just like somebody who was big a few years ago and done much since. So just But anyway,
it's odd, odd choice.
Yeah,
yeah. So yeah, mate. You know, mate. John Krasinski's kind of one of those. He's not a mega star. You know, A Quiet Place did well. Don't get me wrong. Got a lot of buzz, but he's not like a massive leading man.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, it is one of those things. Just on the subject of that safe, I've got to remind you of this. In the first episode of that, there was a brilliant thing on Twitter not so long back. The first episode of that, there's a scene where Michael C. Hall's character's playing football with like his family and whatnot at like a party. And he kicks the ball, right? It's this end of this shot, right? You see from a distance. He kicks the ball and towards the net, but he hits the post, right? And he misses, but he reacts like he scored, right? And it's very clear that he hit the post. And obviously, they couldn't film it again. But you see, if you watch everyone else, they don't really know how to react because they're all supposed to go, yay! But then he's hit the post. So they think, oh, okay, the scene, they're going to have to refilm this, aren't they? But he's there going, woo, I've scored! It's so obvious he hit the post. You just go back and watch it, seriously, because it had me in bits. I kept rewatching it, like, so much. It was just brilliant. But anyway, that's a massive sidebar. But yeah, Jack Ryan might be worth it. You know, we might see some stuff on Set the Tape about that and check it out. So yeah, we'll see. And welcome everyone to Free Play. This week we're back in the world of books and. I'm really pleased to be joined by a friend and podcaster of mine from the Trek FM network, the writer of Hitler's British Isles, a book that's recently come out, all about the history of the Channel Islands during the Second World War and the surprising Nazi occupation of it. It's Duncan Barrett. It's great to have you on Set the Tape Rewind, Duncan. Thanks for coming on.
It's always a pleasure to podcast with you, Tony. It's been a while, but it's good to get on mic again with you.
Yeah, we realise it's been a few months, and that's a shame because I've stepped a little bit away from the Trek FM stuff right now because of all the other myriad things I'm doing. But it's nice to get you on.
You've got more pies than you have fingers, I think. So,
That's a good analogy. Yeah, I think that's spot on. I recently went away to Thailand for my honeymoon, and I read 5 books, one of which was Hitler's British Isles, and it had been which you kindly sent me, and it was something I've been really looking forward to reading. So I've given it a sort of very brief outline there, but do you want to briefly talk about the ultimately what really is in the book before we talk more about it?
Yeah, I mean, basically the book is essentially just a history of the occupation of the Channel Islands during the Second World War, and I think a lot of people in mainland Britain, I mean, certainly when I was I did GCSE and A-level history at school, and we learnt all about the Nazis, we learnt all about the Second World War, we learnt, I think, a bit about the occupation in France, but literally no one ever mentioned that there was British territory that was occupied by the Germans in the war. So really, for me, it was just a case of, you know, first of all, finding out more about that history, because I didn't go into this book knowing a huge amount about it, really, and then bringing that to a kind of mainland audience, because I spent about 3 months in the Channel Islands, mainly in Guernsey, but kind of hopping back and forth to Jersey and Sark as well a couple of years ago, interviewing people about the occupation, about what it was like then. And over there, they're so sort of steeped in the occupation. I mean, they literally can't get away from it because, you know, every beach has these bunkers still left there because they're too much effort to demolish, basically. You know, the occupation is kind of living history for them. But really, I wanted to just kind of bring some of that back home with me, bring some of that back over to the mainland and kind of let people know what it was like. Because I think as English people, this is quite an important part of our history of the war that we've sort of kind of decided to forget about.
I would say also it's something we don't even really know about, you know, certainly. I mean, not in massive terms. I mean, it's something I don't ever remember studying at school. It's something I never really came across until I heard about your book, you know, and then I read all the history, certainly within it.
Mm.
You know, I didn't even know that this had happened. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are probably older than me who did know that, you know, and it's not necessarily something that's obscure, but it's certainly, I don't think, something for my generation, and certainly the generations under me, us, it's something that's necessarily massively well known. And it's a fascinating slice of history because, you know, these people really went through something on the Channel Islands that
the British mainland were terrified of, and it never really experienced. And it's a really fascinating mix of quite, you know, surprising stories about what the Nazis on those islands were really like, and some horrific tales which sort of feel a little bit more like the things we've heard over the years in, you know, some of the countries that were occupied. So it's a surprising book. I found it very surprising.
Yeah, it is a strange mixture, I suppose, the kind of occupation stories. And I'd say, I mean, when I was researching this book, I interviewed, I think it was about 106, 107 people. And everyone has a different story. And there are some things that everyone can kind of agree on. But one of the reasons that I like to work like this, I mean, the kind of history that I do is very much history through the experiences of ordinary people. And I try to interview as many people as I can find and to gather as many stories as possible, partly to so that I'm able to kind of reflect that breadth of experience, because, you know, no two people had the same experience for those 5 years. Some people found it wasn't too bad, you know, or they found the Germans weren't too bad. They got on very well with the ones that, you know, were living locally. I mean, some had them in their houses, you know, and they kind of had to make friends with them to some extent. You know, others remained implacably opposed to them, experienced, an element of cruelty from them. I mean, typically compared to, say, the occupation in France, compared to the occupation in Holland and so on, it was not a brutal regime. I mean, from the top down, it was what was known as a model occupation. It was intended as a kind of soft occupation, with the idea that it was a stepping stone to the occupation of mainland Britain, and that they wanted to kind of prove, the Germans were very keen to prove that they could be sort of just occupiers in a sense, to sort of make a good impression. It was sort of a PR exercise. On the other hand, there was a real shortage of food. Life did get very difficult. There were, whenever something flared up, whenever there was any kind of resistance or kind of not even resistance, but sort of misbehavior, I suppose, they would have to react. So there would be a kind of clampdown of some form or other. And obviously that relationship, as much as they were kind of, the Germans were trying to preserve a sort of good relationship, it would get strained at various points. And as the war went on, for most people, it got tougher and tougher, you know, all the way through, really, up until the point they were liberated.
Yeah. And it struck me that it sort of ebb and flow of how the Germans were on the islands and how they were with the different islanders, and how it sort of it's shifted a bit. I mean, really, I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like the book spends probably more time on in Guernsey than it probably does in Jersey a little bit, or that's how it came across to me. And then the fact that Sark, even though it's a tiny little island, really has its own unique sort of place within it. So did you find that there were more stories sort of on Guernsey, or was it fairly evenly spread?
I mean, I made the same amount of effort on all the islands to find as many people to speak to as I could. I was living on Guernsey, so it may be partly that I kind of made more contact there. I sort of got to know more people on Guernsey. I got to know the local media better there, so I was able to sort of put the word out that way. Whereas Jersey, basically, because I moved my whole family over, you know, myself, my partner, my son, my two dogs, we were all living in Guernsey for 3 months, and then I was kind of island hopping from there. So if there is that kind of bias in the book, that might be part of it. I think there's also a sense, though, that for me anyway, my impression coming there as an outsider was that the history of the occupation is a bigger part of kind of daily life in Guernsey than it is in Jersey, maybe. And that's not to say that they've kind of forgotten about it in Jersey or it's not important, but Jersey is a big, you know, it's substantially bigger island. It sort of feels like there's a lot more going on. It feels a bit more of a kind of modern place somehow. So I think maybe my sense was that people in Guernsey, it was more something that was important to them to talk about. Not to say that wasn't the case in Jersey for the people that I did speak to, but it seemed like it was a bigger deal there. Sark, absolutely, a very small community. And I was quite lucky there. I had a local woman who sort of got in touch with me and offered to help me and basically organised a whole itinerary of interviews for me with all her local contacts that she'd been, you know, making friends with over the years, and sort of twisted their arms to talk to me. So I did manage to speak to probably a disproportionately high number of people on such a tiny island because I had someone locally kind of making the introductions for me. So, you know, that definitely helped.
Yeah, and quite a lot of people who were either there, you know, or people who knew people who were connected to it. I mean, I was really struck by Werner Rang and his wife's story. I mean, that and it's very sad at the end to find out they died very recently, you know, over a span of a few months connected. And they were like very close to the 100 mark at that point. Yeah. So it must have been incredible to speak to to speak to them and get their recollections, because the story of Werner especially is a really fascinating one as a Nazi who falls in love with Sark and falls in love with a woman there. It's quite a beautiful story in the midst of this very dark little chapter as well.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's a very romantic story, I think. And and there were romantics. I mean, there were romances that happened, and there were a handful that endured. I mean, I'd say most of the kind of wartime romances died the death as soon as the war ended. But yeah, Werner and Phyllis was an unusual one insofar as, you know, he was absolutely besotted with her. Do you know what I mean? It was really kind of pretty much love at first sight, and a love that lasted, as you say, through to the end of their lives, you know, in their 90s. I think for him, one of the things that struck me about him, though, as well, was that as much as he fell in love with Phyllis, this local girl, he also fell in love with Sark. You know, I mean, his eyes lit up when he talked to me about what it was like coming there for the first time. The Germans described Sark as a little paradise. And for anyone who's never been to the Channel Islands or never been to Sark in particular, I mean, Channel Islands are really stunning. I mean, they're British territory, but they are really beautiful islands. I mean, if you think of, you know, say Cornwall, you're kind of getting onto the right track. But the fact that they're quite small, the fact that they are islands means, you know, you've got this stunning coast all the way around. Beautiful kind of natural geography. And Sark in particular is very magical because it is very tiny. It's very kind of old-fashioned, traditional place. I mean, even if you go there today, there are no cars on the island. So the roads, such as there are kind of dirt tracks, basically. And you notice as soon as you get there how quiet it is, how it has this kind of different atmosphere, how there are more insects, there are more birds, you know, because you don't have any pollution, you don't have any of that. It is like a sort of, well, like an island paradise, like Werner described it. Mm. And I think for a lot of the Germans coming to the Channel Islands in general, that was an element of it, was just falling in love with the stunning scenery, with these, you know, beautiful villages, with the kind of generally quite friendly. I mean, I think the people in the Channel Islands, and particularly somewhere like Sark, which is so tiny, you know, there is a real kind of community spirit, and there is a real kind of culture of being friendly and generous to outsiders and these kind of things. And in a way, as much as the Germans were sort of technically the enemy, while the islands were occupied, you know, there wasn't really any fighting going on or whatever. And they kind of benefited to some extent from that just sort of natural human warmth in a way.
Yeah. And it's made, I tell you what, it's made me really want to go. I mean,
shame you've just had your honeymoon. You should, I don't know if they can quite compete with the Thai beach, but you know, there's a lot of charm there, definitely.
It probably would have been a lot cheaper. To be honest,
definitely a lot cheaper. Yeah.
But, absolutely. And I think that's what one of the things that really get out of the book. You not only get this really interesting chapter, especially, you know, if you're a fan of Second World War history. I mean, I am, you know, I really like reading about all that stuff. And it felt like a little corner of that, you know, story that you didn't know, you know, from a perspective you didn't know. And I think, you know, I think the book really brings out that, and it brings out the beauty of the place. You know, you really get a feel for the place. You feel like you're quite immersed in the setting. So I think you can tell you lived there, you know, because you seem to really breathe it in the book, and it seemed to really sort of imbue the words, I think. So it's a surprising book in the sense of the kind of story it tells. And I think I can understand potentially why it appealed to you, you know, to tell this chapter.
Well, it certainly appealed to me. It's a story that's always appealed to me ever since. I can't remember when I first actually heard about the occupation, but as I say, it certainly wasn't when I was learning history at school. And it always kind of stuck in my mind as sort of, oh, what a fascinating topic. I'd love to kind of, you know, learn more about that. I'd love to go there and talk to those people. And I suppose it made sense for me because I've written quite a few books about the Second World War, and in particular the home front in Britain of the Second World War, and what that was like for people. And in a way, I think the Channel Islands story is kind of the ultimate home front story, because you've got all the kind of, you've got that sort of blitz spirit. I mean, they weren't literally being blitzed over there, apart from one brief and quite shocking incident at the very start, just before the occupation. They didn't really have that to contend with, but they had all these other problems of, you know, food shortages and sort of general anxiety about what was going on in the war, and kind of just having to kind of get through it, having to make do, having to find some way of feeding the family, having to find some way of, you know, providing clothes for the family, all those kind of things that people on the home front in Britain went through. But then they've also got the fact that, you know, the enemy are literally living next door, or in some cases living in their spare room. And this whole sort of dilemma of, you know, how much do you kind of preserve that kind of idea of patriotic distance when actually the person that, you know, you're sort of, you've been taught that you're supposed to hate is very polite and charming and on their best behaviour and, you know, is bringing around presents for your children because they miss their own children at home. You know, how long do you kind of keep up that pretense that we're not all just human beings, you know, sort of trying to get on with our lives? And I think in the Channel Islands also, I should probably, just to be clear, pretty much every one of those 100-odd people I interviewed said this. One of the things that nearly everyone said the same thing was, well, we had the Germans, they weren't really Nazis. And I think there is certainly a great degree of truth in that the troops who ended up there were not necessarily ardent, you know, card-carrying National Socialists. A lot of them were not that keen on the, you know, not to say that they wanted to lose the war, but they weren't that committed to winning it. They felt they were quite lucky. They'd got this very cushy posting. There was no fighting there. You know, it was kind of sort of ideal posting if you were a conscript in the army who didn't really want to go off to Russia and, you know, die in the snow or have to kill people or whatever. So not only were they on their best behaviour because they'd been told to behave, but they were kind of immediately put in a good mood by this beautiful posting that they'd been sent to and kind of aware that they had lucked out really to be sent there.
You know, that complication is there in terms of, you know, who the Germans were and, like you say, that division between a German and a Nazi and everything like that. So, you know, it really comes across in the book. It's a really interesting book. It's a great slice of history. I think anyone who has an interest in certainly in Second World War history and history in general, and particularly from a social perspective, because it is all these little, you know, moments in people's lives that connect up and then revisited and things like that. It's a really nice, charming book that will, you know, uncover an area of history I don't think you will potentially know. So I recommend it hugely, and I think it's a great little book, which is available now on Amazon and, you know, in all good bookshops, really, isn't it? And I think you can pick it up pretty widely.
Should be, yeah. I mean, if your bookshop doesn't have it, ask them why not. I mean, hopefully you should be able to pick it up in most bookshops at the moment. It's also on Audible. If you go to Audible, you can even have me reading it, which is, you know, might be a dubious pleasure. But, you know, I don't know about you. I personally was amazed when you said you read 5 books in the course of your honeymoon. I find these days I just have so little time for actually sitting down and reading. I do most of my reading through audiobooks these days, so, you know.
It's great. I had the virtue of being in a villa with a pool and, you know, hours and hours in which my wife and I just sat there reading, and it was just wonderful for a week. So I read fairly fast, so I was able to barrel through quite a few, which never happens at home. Yeah. So you're fighting for the time to do it. So it was lovely. It was an idyllic place to read a book like this and get soaked up by it. Yeah. So
that's what I'll have to do next. I have to find an excuse to write a book about Thailand and go and live there for 3 months instead of live on the beach.
Do that. Just write books about the most exotic, beautiful places in the world. There you go. Sorted. thanks for coming on the show, Duncan. It's been really nice to speak to you about this book, and all the success in the world for it, because it really deserves to be read widely. So thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you, Tony. Well, it's a pleasure to speak to you again.
That's time on another edition of Set the Tape Rewind. We'll be back in 2 weeks for more of the same, but until then, don't forget to check us out on Facebook and on Twitter at Set the Tape. And of course, you can find all our articles, features and reviews at www.setthetape.com. Until next time, thanks as always for tuning in.